This is Human Rights Radio. I'm Jesse Bangu. You might think that reporters define what is news, but reporters cannot be everywhere, nor can they verify every source of information. So they rely on government or corporate news bureaus and a stable of experts who provide analysis. They often get the official news from an established bureaucracy, either government or business, and consult experts to interpret it and provide an alternative opinion. Smaller newspapers use a less sophisticated process. They sometimes use the results of larger newspapers. In general, it is common for one source to start a story, then others will pick it up if it proves to be popular. But is the public getting the complete and balanced story through this approach? Again, Robert Jensen.
The contemporary commercial media system, especially the television networks and the cable channels, which is where most people get most of their news, have done just an abysmal job over time of making the American public understand what's going on in the world.
Also, consider a study done on the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour in 1985. Journalists constituted only 25% of the total number of news sources. Out of the remaining non-journalist experts, about 54% were current and former government officials from the United States. So, over half of the outside opinions came directly from the U.S. government, which in many cases supplied the original story. 16% came from think tanks established to promote conservative, usually corporate, viewpoints. Again, Robert Jensen comments.
The official sources, people that come from the officially recognized institutions like government and military and corporations and think tanks, they tend to sort of take up most of the oxygen in the media, and they present us a view of the world that is very supportive of certain power interests in the United States.
Why do journalists allow a significant bias like this? Again, the major reasons are financial, as all political parties become large advertisers during political campaigns. Also, the big media companies make large political contributions, solidifying their symbiotic relationship. Also, media companies rely on the government for both broadcasting license and for access to government officials, their most significant news source. But are individual reporters affected by these kind of political affiliations?
If you've ever worked in journalism, you know that if you buck that agenda, if you're the State Department reporter and you stand up at a State Department briefing and you say, well, sir, what you've just said is obviously a lie, and what about, you know, the American support for these atrocities and that, you know, that's probably your last day as a State Department reporter for your newspaper.
But aside from financial and political constraints, the media follows other implicit guidelines, mostly self-imposed, but some are enforced by special interest groups. Because all media sources seek large audiences, they conform to certain unstated standards for content in order to get the approval of the largest segment of the audience. They also have to avoid offending smaller minority populations. Constrained by these guidelines and motivated by increasing their market share, media companies can easily be attracted into sensationalist news stories to entice a larger audience. Back in 1898, newspapermen Joseph Pulitzer and William Randolph Hearst knew that exciting stories sell papers, so they began a propaganda campaign that may have started the Spanish-American War. Hearst's newspapers falsely reported that Spain torpedoed an American battleship, the Maine, near Cuba. His reporters crafted the story to capitalize on recent events in Cuba and to appeal to readers' emotions, which would ultimately sell newspapers. These reports, along with other fabricated stories of atrocities attributed to the Spanish, turned public opinion in favor of a war. Spain attempted a diplomatic solution, but talks failed, and the United States declared war against Spain on April 25, 1898. This exaggerated, emotional style became known as yellow journalism, and although it was generally criticized by the media, it remained popular and continues to this day, although with more restraint. For example, most news services have explicit guidelines prohibiting fabrication of stories, but still use emotionally charged language to attract the public. Television broadcasts seem most vulnerable to this new form of sensationalism. Television producers know that emotion sells a program better than dry facts, and that visual media transmit emotions better than print. As a result, news stories tend to report on human responses to events instead of the actual facts. But is this an unfair characterization? Consider the recent wave of news stories on child abduction. A relatively small number of cases vaulted this problem onto front pages and special television reports, whose emphasized enticing phrases like sweeping the nation and epidemic proportions. In reality, the number of child abductions by strangers has decreased in recent years. The only thing that has increased is the amount of press coverage devoted to the problem. Personal safety is a powerful hook to attract viewers. If you feel that reading or watching a special report will improve your safety, then the media has reached its goal. In fact, the source of danger being reported may be an isolated incident and may not have even been covered at all on a busier news day. In fact, a general program on standard personal security precautions would probably be more helpful to most people, but would not be as attractive as the sensationalist program and therefore has less chance of being aired. By now, you may wonder how these factors affect the main topic, how the media affects how we view human rights. We will look at this in the next part of the report. This is Human Rights Radio. I'm Jesse Bangu.